It's time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. One thing we notice about running a monthly media segment in our time is that the topics come fast and furious, often changing right up to airtime. That's okay. There's always plenty to talk about, and we do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here from the communication faculty at Southern Oregon University. Andrew Gay, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Precious Yamaguchi, good to see you.
Hi, nice to see you today.
And this will be the last time we see Precious before she gives birth to her second child in 10 days.
Yes.
So glad to have you here for what may be the last time for a while. So let's get right to the list. And it's so hard in this day and age where politics and media are so closely intertwined to not make it all politics, but we have endeavored to get there. But one of the more interesting developments for me is the President of the United States tweeting the fully spelled out word that I can only refer to as BS, and managed to keep a federal broadcast license in all caps. And to look at the different ways that news organizations dealt with this, NPR, for example, just edited it out, referred to the rest of the comment and not the BS part. Mm-hmm. NBC headlined it. That, I thought, was indicative of the kinds of decisions that news organizations have to make in delivering news of what's going on in the country.
Right. I saw also a CNN clip where Jake Tapper sort of gave a little speech of saying, and now parents, if you have small children in the room, you may want them to leave because we're going to discuss a statement by the president. It's like, oh, that's the interesting times we're living in.
Yeah, truly.
Yeah, I feel that he, in his place of privilege, he does use language that's inappropriate that would get someone scolded or fired in any other type of position. And he kind of throws around this type of authority within the media, just seeing like what gets him attention, what things work, maybe some things anger people, and that's okay with him.
It's interesting not only on that basis, though, about you know, who chooses to use the word BS or not, fully spelled out or not, or just to ignore it completely, but also just with the barrage of stuff that comes out, particularly in this time of impeachment, which we haven't talked about, impeachment inquiry since you guys have been here. Just the fact that there is so much news right now, you really do have to pick and choose carefully because you got so much time if you're a broadcaster, so much space. If you're in print, well, less of an issue on the web now, I find.
Right. I guess you'd think that we would be done being shocked, but there's still things that feel shocking. I mean, when you see it on Twitter from the official presidential, you know, Twitter account, it's kind of an odd thing, and I think it is newsworthy. What was odd also is, like, you know, I think it was just within hours later, he was on a press conference with I think it was the Finnish president, and he kept referring to the blank strap instead of saying the word jock strap, which, you know, it was like
that. Yeah, that's an interesting, good point to bring up. That in Twitter, he'd say whatever's on his mind. But
it's really like is the word jock like a? I mean, hopefully, I'm not breaking any rule. I don't think that's a word that you have to.
It's not going to get our license pulled.
Yeah, exactly. Sure that. Yeah, so it's like what a odd choice to censor that, but then to tweet in all caps the BS.
So all right, so then here we are as media people trying to cover all this. But so let's get into another angle then of media and politics, which is a criticism that was printed in as a Larry Menty column in the Mail Tribune yesterday. Not the only one by far, but pointing out that isn't it media bias that people aren't covering the Joe Biden story about Hunter Biden and his dealings with the gas company Burisma in Ukraine, because so many broadcasters do come back and say, no, this has been disproven. This case has been disproven.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have seen coverage of it. Obviously, it's not as much as the I think the story of accusations that the president made is a different story than what the president did. But you know, most of the claims are false, right, that we know about. There have been stories that have said, you know, there's no basis. There's been no public evidence of what's being shared. So I think, you know, are we going to keep covering something that is so far there's not been evidence provided to support the claims that the president's making about this scandal? So I do think I think what I've seen that's been alarming is more that is the trend to sort of cover the story or to refer to the story like, oh, will this affect Biden's run, or, you know, all those kinds of things, and not explicitly saying these are claims that to date there's no evidence to support the claims that are being made. And I think too often the media is actually covering it as sort of mentioning what the president says, but not actually also saying, and by the way, we know that this is false.
And it's a lot of the information, too, like looking at the story in the bigger picture. It's not like a new, incredibly new breaking story. It's like been covered in different pieces, like 2016, 2014.
New York know had that. A big piece about Hunter Biden 3 months ago.
Yeah, and Hunter Biden, I mean, if we look at his lifetime and what he's like accomplished with like air quotes, we see that there is like privilege. And I mean, a lot of it has been tied to privilege and place.
It's been marked by relationship problems and drug abuse and more.
Right.
Yeah.
And being discharged from the military. So it's not something that's all happened within like the last few months. It's been happening within like 5 years and more.
But there's an irony too, in which I think Eric Trump published an op-ed in The Hill or something like that, talking about the vice president Shun should not be profiting from his father's position in power, and again, you're just sort of like, where's the self-awareness in this situation?
Yeah, he says hypocrisy creates an unlevel playing field in politics. But, there's a point you brought up, Andrew, just a moment ago about the headlines about, will this affect Biden's run? But mm-hmm. but the way you stated that is really indicative of how a lot of web headlines work, where
yes.
they do ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even if the answer is no, right. the fact is it's asking the question makes it look like, oh, this is a real problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, I love those, there's different accounts that are like saved you a click or whatever. And it's like, there's always, some kind of crazy headline and then it says, the it's retweeted by saved you a click and the answer is no.
Yeah, right.
I didn't have to read that story. Thank you.
Yeah, my years in TV promotions taught me that you want to set things up like, you won't believe what happens next.
Yeah.
And the answer is sometimes, well, not much. This is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange. Our regulars are here, Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University. Items you'd like to talk about, bring them to the table, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. All right, let's shift gears away from politics just a bit, although it's not completely divorced here, but it's Sandy Hook Promises put out a public service announcement. I would like to play it, but it is so visual that the audio wouldn't make a lot of sense. What it amounts to is these children holding up their new back-to-school stuff, like, I got this great new backpack from my mom. I got this great new skateboard from my dad. And you realize the tone is getting progressively grimmer as the PSA goes on. As, for example, the kid with the skateboard breaks a window to get away from an active shooter. And the kid who talks about his great new sneakers is running away from an active shooter. So, I mean, it's a really gripping PSA, unlike any I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. When you see it, it just feels very mild at first, and then it gets more intense. And then after it's done, you're like, what did I just see? And then if you're watching television, you see it again, and it's just as intense. Like a lot of times when you watch a commercial the first time, by the second time you see it, you kind of just like blank it out. But I felt like every time I saw it, it almost became more emotional. And that short commercial really had a story to it. And I also felt like it does get people to act and hits our emotions in the way that it was intended to.
Yeah, I think that was very compelling. Whoever made that should win awards for the campaign. It was very well done. And it's real, right? I mean, I think we, on the first day of classes at SOU, I was in our digital media center, which has windows all around it. And there's kind of this big concrete wall right outside. And there's some kind of loud construction noise or something, like a really loud bang. I recognize it as being something like that. But immediately the bang was followed by a scream. I looked up and saw a student run and duck behind this concrete wall and started sobbing. And I just kind of watched through the window as she sort of like it sunk into her that it wasn't what she thought it was. But she, kind of calmly collected herself and then walked away. But, that's the world our students are living in, college students down to elementary students. And it's, I think that was a really compelling message.
And the message that Sandy Hook Promises delivers in that PSA is that school shootings are not inevitable. They are preventable. And so let's talk about how we can save more lives is the message that we're left with. But it's worth taking a look at online. I'll make sure that I link to this from our page here about today's Signals and Noise to make sure that people can get right to it. It is really worth a look. Let's move on here in Signals and Noise to the Ellen and W controversy, where a Dallas Cowboy Green Bay Packer game over the weekend featured the shots of the luxury boxers, and there was former President George W. Bush and his wife Laura Bush sitting next to Ellen DeGeneres and her wife Portia de Rossi, and. Ellen DeGeneres said a lot of people were mad, and they did what people do when they're mad. They tweet. And so so she had to respond to this. And here's a clip of what she did on her show 2 days later.
Here's the thing. I'm friends with George Bush. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have. We're all different, and I think that we've forgotten that that's okay that we're all different. For instance, I wish people wouldn't wear fur. I don't like it, but I'm friends with people who wear fur. And I'm friends with people who are furry, as a matter of fact. I have friends who should tweeze more. And I have, but just because I don't agree with someone on everything doesn't mean that I'm not going to be friends with them. When I say be kind to one another, I don't mean only the people that think the same way that you do. I mean be kind to everyone.
So an interesting collection of things. We got the political, we got the entertainment, we got the mass media, we got the tweet media. So all these things pulled together. Go.
Yeah, well, and that was not the end of it. You know, there was interesting, you know, a lot of people really rallied around Ellen after that message saying, oh, you know, what a refreshing message in these divided times. And then she also got a lot of blowback saying, you know, for instance, there is one video that I saw that someone had did a very good job sort of compositing images of kind of atrocities from the Iraq War behind Ellen as she's speaking, and it's just, you know, really kind of an awful image. Certainly not the one kind of thing a celebrity like Ellen wants to see. And there's been other weird fallout, like the star of The Good Place, Jamila Jamil, who's from the UK. Had first sort of applauded Ellen's statement, like, oh, what a good statement. Then she got some blowback and she said, oh, I'm just been reading about George W. Bush's presidency. And, you know, I realized what a terrible presidency. And then she's getting flack for saying, well, how did you not know what was going on? How are you just figuring this out? And she's like, well, I was 17 in the UK. And I kind of think, like, you know, what 17-year-old could explain Brexit to us? You know, it's been a really interesting kind of storm of relitigating the W presidency through the venue of Ellen DeGeneres, which is unexpected.
Yeah, I think that it's a bit complicated because people of marginalized groups, it's not like we have a singular point of view of everything. So, and also just like having been in different international contexts and countries, if you are American and you're around a bunch of different people from, like, just having dinner or drinks with different people of different countries, there always comes a time where, oh, you're American. You must believe in, like, oil no health care, like treating people badly. And then there are times where I've been like, well, you know, that is not me. But then people will be like, oh, but you're affiliated with, like, United States, so you must think that. So I think that In some cases we do have certain type of privilege. In other cases we are marginalized, but there's no one singular, like, we all believe in this one thing and we all have the same group of friends. It could be really difficult, I think.
That level of associations, though, where it's like, well, you know, you're Ellen, so you shouldn't be with George W. Bush, or you're Jamila Jamil, so you should know about how bad George W. Bush was, instead of supporting Ellen's right to be with George W. Bush. And it's, you know, the whole guilt by association thing, particularly in a time of instantaneous media in everybody's hands, gets pretty wild.
Yeah, I saw another good tweet from that was an interesting insight, which just said, you know, y'all are mad at Ellen for not yelling at George W. Bush when you're going to go have Thanksgiving with your Trump supporting uncle and not say a thing. And so I think it was an interesting, and this was an African American tweeter, kind of drawing out that, like, you know, we sometimes say, you know, we want our celebrities, our people who sort of have a higher voice to confront, you know, atrocities or something. But, you know, when we have, like, the racist uncle who says something, maybe we just kind of roll our eyes and don't say anything. So I think that was an interesting insight as well.
Let's take a call. Grumpy John of Grants Pass wants to talk about the American press. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange and Signals and Noise. Grumpy John, you there?
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, you there.
Okay. I am just distressed by these gaggle of reporters. When Trump walks out and says, oh, you're a bunch of fake news. I want to know why they don't have the guts to stand up to him and say, just name two stories that were fake. Instead of, oh, I got a question. Why are they so subservient? They don't stick up for themselves and say, no, we are not fake news. You are a liar.
Well,
why this is happening in our country today.
I'll lead off there because I've been in the news business for 35 plus years. But the fact is that you don't get to defend yourself like that. Generally, you're supposed to be the neutral observer. And even when people call attention to you as the observer, you're still trying to be invisible. Is that the right way in this time? I'm not in that situation myself. I can't say for sure, but let me get thoughts from the other two.
I think that there have been times when people do try to defend themselves on Twitter or like in print and probably also in person. We might just not see it. The camera has certain selective things that they capture. I haven't followed every journalist, so I know that there are journalists who are not subservient that really do fight back, but we just might not be able to see it.
We've seen a couple examples of that. I do agree they're seldom, and I think what ends up happening is that oftentimes it doesn't actually help. The reporter then becomes the story, right. and I think the administration has been pretty deft at using that to kind of rile up their own base again, saying like, oh, look, see, they are against me.
See, they are mean. Yeah.
Right, yeah. But, you know, I've seen two really great examples, and I wish I knew the reporters' names, but, in the second press conference with the Finnish president, there is, I think, an AP reporter who just would not let Trump off the hook with a question, and the president kept, going back at him, and he said, sir, with all due respect, you haven't answered the question.
Right, the Reuters reporter.
Yeah, Reuters, yeah. And it was interesting because a lot of the other reporters on Twitter instead are like, oh, yeah, good job. And sort of the response to me is sort of like, all right, so why aren't you all doing that? Because I think so often they do ask a question, he says whatever, and it just moves on. But, you know, that reporter did a really good job. And then I think just yesterday, another reporter, and I don't know what outlet it was with, did the same thing with Vice President Pence, really drilling down about, you know, were you aware of this exchange over a military aid? And, you know, he just did not let up. And it was a really great moment because you could see the vice president did not have a good answer for this. And so I think that's really powerful. I would rather see reporters drill down on those questions and not let people in power off the hook than see them sort of like, you know, oh, stop calling me the fake press.
Yeah, so not get into tit for tat, but actually respond with some meat, some real stuff. We're going to skip over net neutrality in the interest of time because as long as we're on this topic, it makes sense to move into the other idea, the price of withholding news for a book deal, where, for example, the information about just more recently than the discussion of the New York Times reporters writing the book about Trump wanting an alligator moat at the U.S. border came these other allegations of more sexual assault, another 43 allegations of alleged inappropriate behavior, including 26 instances of unwanted sexual contact. And it raises the question of what is the reporter's responsibility? Report it then or hold it until book time?
I think it's complex because sometimes when really important information like this is available, it has to also be strategic in which it's not just going to get brushed off. So sometimes building a context, building a case, making sure that everyone has the type of coordination and agreement that is needed. So it really depends. I feel like the Me Too movement was really also based upon being strategic and just coordinating things because it's so easy to put your information out there but then suddenly get silenced or just not have that information go through. Not that everyone should like wait for a book deal, but it has to be kind of organized, I think.
Although, you know, this information came out, I think, yesterday about this 43 new women, which 43, yeah, that is a staggering number, right? And it still was barely a blip in the news because of everything else going on between Syria and impeachment. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting. There is a lot of blowback, especially with the alligator moat story. And I think, again, I think there are a lot of questions now because of when other women have come forward. You know, when did reporters know what? And could they have supported these other allegations earlier? There's that tension between the public's right to know You know, what do citizens need sort of in their arsenal of knowledge, and then what sometimes are the best way to communicate a bigger story? Sometimes that is a book, but these tidbits are interesting.
As long as we're talking about sexual assault, I'll close this topic with the Oregonian in yesterday's print edition, and it's been on the web for a couple of days now, talking about the daughter of the founder of Mercy Corps, who was sexually assaulted by her father for years in her childhood, brought it to the attention of Mercy Corps people in the 90s, and they didn't do anything. Brought it to their attention again last year, and they didn't do anything. So it's another example of cases where, and then when she finally came forward and went public with it and put her name out there, a friend of hers from high school said, "Oh yeah, he abused me too." So it's just the whole issue of sexual assault and the way we cover it and the way we deal with it is, that's fodder for several more hours of the program.
I feel like it's just nothing. Like, it's been happening for decades and decades, and women have been silenced and overlooked. Not just women, but people have been silenced and overlooked for so long. So none of it is new. It's just like the different ways in which we organize and get our voices out there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well said, Precious. So we have just about a minute and a half for pick threes from each of you. So take about 30 seconds each.
Precious?
Okay. I'll go with The Undocumented, A Worker's Fight, which is actually a graphic novel by Duncan Tontia. And it's beautiful. I mean, the story is heartbreaking, but it's also a beautiful graphic novel. Lenny, the Boston Terrier, who is one of the first official dog hotel critics. He gets to travel to 10 different hotels anywhere in the world, and he gets to critique the hotels on his travel.
That's totally a Precious pick.
And Skid Row Marathon, which showed at the Ashland Film Festival last year. I really wanted to see it, but didn't get to. Saw it, and it's amazing.
Okay. Well, I'll just throw out one. My students in the digital cinema program at SOU created a promotional video, a really awesome promotional video for our program, and it's going to screen at Coming Attraction Theaters in all 18 locations in 4 states, and we're really excited for the next 2.5 months. It's going to be the broadest exhibition of student work we've ever had.
Okay, the digital, well, and I saw your post the other day, but we started this new digital cinema major. What have we done? So thanks for the insights, as always, Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi from the Communication Faculty at Southern Oregon University for this month's edition of Signals and Noise. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the end of this hour of the Jefferson Exchange.